India, for example, probably has a demand in the type of high-grade footwear we produce larger than Australia, having 800 or 900 million people, even though it's a small percentage of that market. And so perhaps companies like ours working within the framework can provide, satisfy a little bit of that market, rather than have the executives travel overseas and take foreign exchange and buy high-grade goods offshore. They can perhaps be bought within the company. So that's a long-term benefit that can come out of offshore investment. So while initially we're interested mainly in buying for our markets and export for the developing nation, it can have a benefit by also satisfying an internal need and saving foreign exchange. I must say, however, that unfortunately there are too many manufacturers in a highly protected country like Australia, and I just went on ABC to make this statement because it's a hot issue at the moment, with, as I say, their heads in the sand and not sufficiently committed to long-term programs. They use, therefore, great political clout to sustain unrealistically high levels of protection to ensure their manufacturing operations remain in a protected environment as long as possible without facing the difficult but inevitable task of establishing more efficient operations in developing nations. That's what I believe. I stood alone as president of the footwear manufacturers a year ago. Every vote went against me when I was trying not to support raising the duty in footwear next year from the 1st of April from 40% to 50%, and that was the government decision that finally won the day, because if you remember, there was a great move against Senator Button where they tried, and even the manufacturers led a program to try and unseat him at the next election, if you recall. And that's the sort of tactics that some people will resort to in industry associations to get what they want. Whereas I believed a plan that encouraged us to restructure offshore, where we could sustain over perhaps a 3 or 4 or 5 year period a situation where we could face and live in an environment with lower tariffs. We actually forewent that opportunity a year ago. And most of them, apart from myself, most of the manufacturers then went for higher protection levels. And that's the issue that's being reviewed at the moment. So that's a fairly detailed, involved situation, and I don't want to deal with it here, but maybe at question time. In essence, therefore, the thrust in our company is that with our self-imposed growth goals, we will inevitably move through a transition to an Australian headquartered West Pacific Basin footwear company in the years ahead. And I also believe very strongly that Australia and countries like us are not culturally suited to employing people who are interested in working in some factory environments in this country. Many people don't want to work in factories. In fact, factory workers do everything they can to train their young people to get on and get education and not be employed in factories. So I say the opportunity in developing nations to employ people who need and appreciate employment is the best form of aid that we can give. At the same time, we in the West can gain the benefit of obtaining suitable competitive products which satisfy the marketplaces in which we operate. In conclusion, I did say that I would refer to one of the offshore aid programs I was involved in, because we talked earlier about, I think Brian Healy didn't get the chance to talk about, the involvement of his executives in more than just the manufacturing or marketing operations of their company. So I'd like to expand on that. I feel that this is one of the best ways, forms of aid, is to encourage executives, as our company has done, and I certainly have some of my executives supporting my personal involvement, and also a board representing people of goodwill in the state of Victoria in particular, have become involved in one aid program, and it's really an exciting, innovative Australian cattle project on the southernmost tip of India. It's a farm that not only uses high-grade cattle, and we have had trouble getting semen into India because the Indian government opposed it, but the Indian High Commission is taking up the battle for me. Just this week, we expect a decision to break down that little bureaucratic barrier. The farm has high-grade Australian, mainly Frisians. We took Jerseys there 10 years ago. They didn't do so well, being a tropical place, to produce milk. It has become also a training centre for underprivileged tribal groups and other people in cattle management, coupled with rubber and copra and nutritional crop planting programs. The dairy farm used as a centre for our activities supplies its own milk bars, with funds flowing back to the farm and with some assistance from the Indian government, villagers can obtain low interest loans to allow Australian crossbreed cattle producing 10 times the milk production of the local cows to be purchased, providing they are trained by us to handle and feed a cow which they can own. In addition, the farm, as a part of its outreach work, operates health clinics with doctors and provides training on health and hygiene. An interesting group we work with are the Kanakar tribals. They are the forerunners of the Australian Aborigines. They live in impoverished conditions in the hill country with high mortality rates as high as 50%. Our work enables them to develop crops which raise the level of nutrition, and we are currently experimenting with an exciting new development whereby lucerne is used as a high protein component to be included in the local curry foods, with surplus being used to stock feed. We're using a new prototype machine that's been designed by an aid program in the UK, and it looks very, very promising indeed. A teaspoon and a half gives 70% of the daily protein. I believe that as a matter of principle, broad involvement by executives at transnationals in areas of local need, apart from the specific corporation's tasks, is a way we can positively fulfil our sense of social responsibility and at the same time help the people in a developing nation in a very real and positive way. Our training as executives can indicate to local peoples how to go forward under their own momentum and progress under local leadership and direction. My concept for fulfilment and satisfaction for the peoples of the world is summed up in these words. He or she who dares to be adventuresome and different will often seem to be unrealistic and unsupported. But if our vision is firmly set on giving our talents without reservation when they are needed and acceptable to others, then we will all be better off, but more especially the giver. For that great man, St. Francis of Assisi, said, "It is in giving that we received." That is my wish for us all, that we find and live this ultimate truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry, for your very fine, excuse me, contribution.
It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Karen Beatty.
Mr. Beatty is a graduate of India's most prestigious college, the St. Stephen's College, within the University of Delhi, and he began his early career in petroleum. He was employed by a joint venture between Burma Oil and Royal Dutch Shell, and in that period had experience in many facets: exploration, refining, marketing, and ultimately became the business development manager for the Burma Group in India, looking after technological transfers and joint ventures. As we all know, the oil industry was nationalised in India in 1979, and Mr. Beatty demonstrated his versatility by moving to Bata, India in 1979, when he became the general manager for Bata, resident in Delhi. And Bata will be known to you as a major international shoe manufacturer. His responsibilities: interaction, government and outside agencies, development of joint ventures with particular emphasis on the small business sector. Mr. Beatty has also had experience in ILO discussions and negotiations in Geneva, and extensive experience in various chambers of commerce and industry. My pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Karam Beatty.
Your Eminence, ladies and gentlemen, I had planned for this audiovisual presentation immediately after lunch because I was hoping that it might give you some respite and some shut-eye maybe after lunch, but it's a little later than that, so the options are still open. I intend to present this in two facets. One is as a audiovisual concerning the operation and the success of joint business ventures, or how I perceive it, and the second as to how Bata India, as a joint business venture in India, has, to my way of thinking, successfully operated, not only as a joint venture per se, as from, shall we say, transference of technology from Canada to India, but for the transference of technology within the country, which I think is more important when it comes to creating employment. Today we've had some excellent statements made by some very, very eminent people, both from government and industry. And before I go on with the presentation, I would just repeat these statements because to some extent these have pertinence to what I am going to talk about. Cardinal Sin talked about liberation from poverty. I think that's a very, very important statement, except that it is largely left as a statement. And I think it's time that we all started working very consciously towards achieving this objective. He talked about the preferential option for the poor. Later on, Dr. Sedar talked about converting opportunities into reality. And there was a statement made, quoted from Peter Drucker, which was that it is the countries are not underdeveloped but undermanaged. And then, of course, Brian Haley talked about learning from each other. Brian in his talk also referred to certain misconceptions that that the governments have of transnational corporations. And in fact, when he tossed the coin, I'm afraid it landed only on one side, because there's always the other side of the coin. And Brian referred more to how the transnationals are mistakenly perceived by the host governments. I think that there is also a conception or misconception of the transnational of the host governments by the transnational corporations. We have some very senior government ministers and officials over here, and I think that if you balance the two out, a long-term relationship can only develop if there is proper understanding of each other. So first, may I, with your permission, proceed with a few view graphs, which will explain some of this proposition. I don't think it is an issue whether joint business ventures are relevant and useful. I don't think it is an issue whether joint business ventures are relevant and useful in product market development activities in the information. The real issue is how they can be useful without creating any negative side effects. Mention was made earlier on the day that by one gentleman who made an observation from the floor that not all joint ventures were in fact beneficial to the host country, and this is of course a possibility, and therefore one has to guard against such negative side effects. In order to maximize their usefulness in markets and product development, such ventures must become internalized rather than operate as foreign companies doing business in the country. Now, I can say this with, I think, some degree of pride concerning Bata, because even in the August audience that we have here today, I was talking to some gentlemen who seemed to think that Bata is a domestic company. And I think the greatest mark of achievement of a company internalizing itself is to be perceived as a domestic company rather than being perceived as a multinational company. Now, the process of internalization has certain components. And I think the most important component of this is really the bilateral attitude adjustment. Because if companies and the country go into partnership with each other in a joint venture, clearly understanding each other's objectives and aspirations, I think that makes for a long-term association, which is the cornerstone of the success of all joint ventures. The other factors, of course, are understood, that one has to have strategic planning of national needs and resources, and reciprocity of bilateral sense. But I think the more important thing in terms of a successful joint venture is to make a long-term bilateral commitment. Now, earlier on, we had it had been mentioned that the host governments sometimes have common stereotypes or misconceptions about multinational companies. And of course, these are stated over there, that these are neocolonial instruments of the Western world. They are counterproductive to developing nations and have no allegiance to any nation. They act as external change agents imposing foreign values and practices, and they have no social conscience and business profit. And business profit is the sole driving force behind their activities. But along with this, the other side of the coin is the misconceptions that the multinationals have about the developing nations. And in fact, with these misconceptions that they have about each other, it is sometimes quite difficult to arrive at any mutuality of understanding, unless there is some sincere thinking and examining and appreciation of each other's point of view. Political leaders are by and large Marxists in their ideology. Their economic manifesto is the only solution for improving the average standard of living in developing nations. Many countries practice reverse colonialism and exploit the multinationals for national as well as personal benefits. Developing countries are so poor and backward that it is impossible to obtain any degree of business efficiency as in advanced countries. Unstable governments make it impossible to plan on a long-term basis, and developing countries have very selfish values. They invite you when needed, but throw you out when they have absorbed your know-how. Unless there is a real bilateral attitude adjustment, joint business ventures which are based on such misconceptions are, I'm afraid, destined to end in a bitter divorce. Go to how to sustain long-term bilateral commitment. In my view, it is very necessary to integrate the business partners in the national strategic planning process by treating them as one additional resource which has a significant role to play in industrial development. In other words, I think when a host country and a multinational, if for the want of a better word, are to get together, they must really the host country must really see that they are inviting a company or a multinational corporation into the country with a long-term objective and motivate them in this manner. And in fact, I think point number three is quite important, that they should not be offered any carrots for entry which subsequently are not going to be there for a long-term operation or long-term commitment. Multinationals provide a worldwide experience of managing business functions in highly diverse conditions. They are, as was explained this morning, more efficient organizations and result in greater productivity. They have a global network of contacts for all types of technical, financial, and human resources. What can governments do? Incentives for establishing ongoing operations. I underlined the word ongoing, that it must be something which is not a short term, but it should be a long-term, stable policy. Policy, as number two states, which is well-defined based on a long-term strategic plan and most importantly, a non-discriminatory attitude towards business, including joint business ventures. Now, I would venture, gentlemen, to go a step further. And in fact, I would like to redefine multinational corporations, because I think that the word multinational is something which is, to my way of thinking at least, somewhat outdated and outmoded, because today any large corporation could be called a multinational, because even a company which operates in more than two countries could be defined as a multinational. But I think basically what any of these companies have to do is that they have to, when they go into a host country, they have to define their policies, their objectives, to match the domestic requirements of that particular country. So it is my belief, gentlemen, that I think perhaps a more realistic definition of some such companies would be multi-domestic rather than multinational. I'll give you the example of what we have done in Bata, India. In Bata, as I have mentioned to you, is a company which is operates in about 100 countries worldwide, but it has successfully become so internalized that today, in many countries, particularly the third world countries, it is perceived as a company which belongs to that particular country. This will be a slide presentation in which I will show to you what the structure of Bata International is and what, in fact, Bata India has been doing to transfer technology within the country and, in fact, to interact with the human face in India. Bata is the world's largest footwear manufacturing and marketing organization. It functions in almost 90 countries of the world. It was founded in 1974 at Zlín, Czechoslovakia. Later on, the headquarters were shifted to Canada in the early 20th century, and this is our international headquarters in Toronto. But the principle of this company has always been what was a statement made by a founder, Mr. Thomas Bata, that in any country, we work to put something into it, not to take something out. It is a totally decentralized operation with all companies totally independent of each other. In fact, we have situations in Bata International where companies compete with each other in terms of export markets. The importing countries, in fact, have no obligation whatsoever to buy from a Bata company worldwide, and everything is dealt with on a totally competitive and business-like basis. In the headquarters of Bata in Toronto, we follow a policy of selection on the basis of ability, and it is here that at any given time we have not less than 10 to 15 nationalities working there on a permanent basis. In fact, India is one of the favored sources for Bata staffing worldwide, and I think in almost all countries in the world we have people working at fairly high levels, including managing directors and highly qualified technical personnel. India is a fast-developing country, but it conjures very contradictory images. In fact, it's not a land of tigers and snakes, as many people might perceive, but it has grown, it's industrialized and urbanized. It has a population of over 800 million and adds roughly one Australia to its population every year. It has, of course, its set of problems, including unemployment, yet it is a very stable democracy with a free press, as my senior colleague from the press in India will tell you, who's a member of our press. It is the 10th largest industrialized nation in the world, and it has the third largest technically trained manpower base in the world, after the United States and the Soviet Union. It has achieved self-sufficiency in food grain production. It manufactures its own automobiles. It manufactures its own aircraft. It has also got a certain amount of atomic energy capabilities. And, of course, it has satellite-based communications for the entire country. As a part of the Bata Worldwide Organization, Bata India Limited is the largest footwear company in Asia, and in fact we constitute roughly 20, all the Bata operates in 100 countries throughout the world. Bata India roughly constitutes 20% of the total Bata Worldwide Organizations, both in the terms of the number of pairs of footwear and our staffing. As you can see, we employ about 18,000 people directly and provide a livelihood to 200,000 people indirectly, and that, I will expand on a little more, is what we call our human face, our interaction with the weaker sections of the society. It is a totally Indian company, as I mentioned earlier, with an Indian board of directors and an Indian managing director, and 60% of the shareholding is Indian, and the policies of this company are totally committed to the Indian economy and the market. It's a very modern company in the sense that to remain competitive, we invest heavily in R&D, state-of-the-art technology, and are continuously upgrading the skills of people through national and international training programs. The head office of this company is in Calcutta, which also has Batanagar, which is, I think, the world's largest footwear factory outside of perhaps Czechoslovakia. This employs over 9,000 people. The other factories are at Bataganj and at Faridabad and Bangalore, and then there are two tanneries at Batanagar, and the Asia's largest tannery is at a place called Mukamaghat on the Ganges. It has the largest retail network in India, and directly or indirectly has got something like 11,000 outlets at the retail level. In line with national objectives, Bata accounts for over 80% of the canvas and rubber footwear exports from India, including some to Australia, I believe, and to countries like the United States and to Canada. And in the last few years, 20 million pairs have This is, we also provide housing for our employees, which is not obligatory, but it's something that we have always done. This morning, Cardinal Sin was talking about the corporations providing hospitals for their employees and for the community, and we have some such schemes operating in India where hospitals are provided for the employees and for the community. We also provide facilities for education. This is not necessarily a school as it is, it's a drawing competition being conducted in the school. Because we provide housing and housing colonies, we naturally have a lot of sporting activities that go with it. In fact, it is not only a company but a sort of a community that exists at our factories. Now, we are committed to the benefit of both society and ourselves. Bata's philosophy makes it totally committed to the mutual benefit of society and itself. We are a company concerned as much with national priorities as with the growth of its business. This is what we call the human face of Bata India. This stems from the realization that business, organization, and society are interdependent, and one cannot grow at the cost of the other. We believe that large and small scale industries are complementary, especially in the footwear business, and they need to grow and prosper together. In fact, we have a program in India, what is called the Partners of Progress program, where we associate with a lot of small scale and underprivileged people and give them the skills to make the footwear. And not only that, but we then take over their production and market it, because I think it is possible for some people to produce, but not necessarily to be able to convert it into a business, into a remunerative activity. Bata, therefore, acts as a catalyst for the small-scale sector. This all started when, in the earlier years, the Bata pioneers went into the interiors of India to help villagers to set up accessory and ancillary units. Villagers were provided with expert technical know-how for flaying and preservation of hides. I might mention over here, gentlemen, to all ladies and gentlemen, to those who are not familiar, that in India, although it has the largest cattle population in the world, the hide and skin business was not developed because the cow is considered sacred, and therefore it was not slaughtered either for its skin or its meat. And therefore, the handling of cow and buffalo skins was something which was left to a certain section of the society which was not familiar with it, or neither was it able to do it very well. And it was the Bata pioneers who went down to the villages and who upgraded the skill and made this into something which was acceptable and honorable. We have encouraged